Boker Tov, everyone. Good morning. Those of you who have assignments, do not lose them, please. Do not disappear. Do not leave before the end. Otherwise, we're going to get very confused. Today, we begin our discussion with a note, an observation. That this may be the greatest mystery in Jewish learning, in Jewish texts. It's a tremendous mystery. It is truly an unsolved mystery to this very day. But before we get to that, let's take a step back and reflect on the book that we're going to study, its introduction today, and it's called the Sefer HaChinuch, which is what you have in front of you. The Sefer HaChinuch, and I'll just hold this edition up. This is the Machon Yerushalayim edition, published in, I think it was in the 80s. Yeah, Tavshin Memches. This volume is, I would say it's probably one of the most widely known and studied works of Jewish law, Compendium of Mitzvot, that's out there. It's a very well-appreciated work for many centuries. And this book, this is only the first of the three volumes of Machon Yerushalayim, but the Sefer HaChinuch enumerates for us all the 613 mitzvos. It begins in Bereishis, and it goes all the way till the end of the Chumash. Now, this idea of counting the mitzvos, of 613 mitzvos, today, I don't know if it's so popular, but in the times of the Rishonim, it was a very popular thing to do, and they did not innovate it, and he did not. The Sefer HaChinuch, the author of this work, did not innovate counting all the mitzvos. The origins of this begins already in the times of the Gaonim. So the Gaonim is the period past the Talmud, let's say the 7th century till the 11th century, give or take. Before that, in the Gemara, you don't find so much of an interest in counting the mitzvos. But with these Moneh HaMitzvos, these mitzvah counters, like the Baal Halachos Gedolos, one of the Gaonim, now you've introduced the totality of Jewish life. And so there is a big benefit, and we'll talk about why this is specifically in this context in a little bit, but there is a big benefit for somebody to say, look, I looked at all the Mishnayos, and I get that that's shorthand for learning. That's notes, note cards. And then I looked at the Talmud, and I got so overwhelmed with everything that's going on over there, the back and the forth, I couldn't grasp the whole thing. It's 2,711 blot. It's too much. So why don't we just try to make sure that we can grasp all of it? So that's good. So we're going to put it all in one book, all of the mitzvahs. Well, it's interesting to think about how many mitzvahs are in this book? 613. Well, how do we know there are actually 613 mitzvahs? It's numbered. What's that?
It's numbered. It's enumerated.
So they enumerate the mitzvahs, but where did they get that enumeration from? Where did they get that numbering system from? The truth is, nobody throw anything at me, it's not clear there are 613 commandments. That's not so clear. That's it. Glenn's ready to walk out at this point. He's had it.
It's like
the truth is, first of all, for anybody who's looking, there are a lot more than 613 commandments. Many, many more. Tons more, of course. But even the number 613, the Ramban, who we're going to talk about in Yirtzeh Hashem next Sunday, please God, Nachmanides, in his comment on the Rambam's Shorashim, the Rambam counted the mitzvos before he gave you all the halachos, he counted all the 613 mitzvos, and the Ramban, in his comments on the Rambam's introduction to his count, because he has to explain to you which ones are in and which ones are out, the Ramban says, let me tell you a secret. I'm not so sure it's 613. And he brings a whole bunch of proofs that in the Gemara, not everybody thought it was 613. But there is a Gemara, there is one passage in the Talmud, in the Ena Maseches Makos, where on the last page of Maseches Makos, there is one opinion that there were 613 commandments. And that opinion is repeated in several places in different Midrashim. And so the Ramban says that took on a place of prominence, and so the general accepted view, even though it's not the exclusive view, is that there are 613 commandments. That doesn't mean that that is the exclusive totality of all mitzvos. That just means in that specific set, there are 613. But a lot of them that we don't count, or that we count it looks like we count them twice for specific reasons. Within that breakdown, which we're not going to focus on today, there are, according to the tradition, 365 negative commandments and 248 positive commandments. That's not accidental. So even if it's not a strictly halachic principle, it's very important from a spiritual standpoint, because the days of the year, they go follow the chama, the sun. That's not coincidental that there are 365 limbs, evarim, and there are 365 negative commandments. That has to do with a whole spiritual dimension of where our spiritual energy comes from Hashem. Those are 365 specific channels. And then there are 248, what we call sinews, that correlate to the 248 days of blessing, perhaps, that you could talk about if you do all the math of which days we say Tachanun and which days we don't say Tachanun. That's a whole other cheshbon. But the idea of the 613 and the 365 and the 248, there's a lot to that. We don't have time to talk about it at length today, but just so we should be aware that A, if somebody tells you there are more than 613 commandments, you shouldn't throw them out, because there may very well be. But number two, the idea that there are specific connections that everybody has to the mitzvos is inherent in everybody's neshama. What's unique and original that the Sefer HaChinuch does is that he organizes them according to the parsha. The Bahag and the Rambam and other Moni HaMitzvos, they just come up with a list. The Sefer HaChinuch organizes it so that you have it according to every parsha, which is great for your Shabbos table, which we'll talk about in a little bit, why that should be important. In the Sefer HaChinuch, every mitzvah has four sections. So first, the Sefer HaChinuch tells you the title of the mitzvah, what number it is. Then he tells you the origin of that mitzvah, the pasuk, the source, where does it come from? So that's number one. Then he tells you what's called the shorish of that mitzvah, which we'll talk about in a second. The shorish literally means the root of that mitzvah. The third thing he tells you are midine ha-mitzvah, some of the laws of this mitzvah. So particulars of what, as the mitzvah of a sukkah, so what comprises a sukkah. And then the last one are the parameters. Who's obligated in this mitzvah? When does that obligation set in? Is it a necessity? Is it something that's voluntary? Is it men, women, Beis HaMikdash, Shlom B'Zman, Beis HaMikdash? Those are the four sections. Now, the second section is perhaps the most interesting and also one of the most innovative, that the Sefer HaChinuch wants us to get what we call the Tam HaMitzvah. What is a Tam, literally? What's that?
Taste.
That's right, a taste. Now, we like to eat breakfast when it tastes good, right? But at the end of the day, I shouldn't speak for anybody else, I, Baruch Hashem, B'siyata D'shmaya, I never skip meals. That's a very bad thing to do. You can't skip a meal. Some people, they get so busy with something, they forget to eat lunch. I don't know how it's possible. Forget to eat lunch. So I'm going to eat lunch, even if I'm on a diet and I'm eating these, they ever see the whole wheat, multi-grain rice cakes, and you put that with a little bit of hummus. That's a whole lunch. Maybe with some carrots, lo aleinu. Is that the most delicious, awesome lunch you ever had? No. But I'm going to eat it anyway because it's lunch. That's what I'm going to have. So the Torah Kedosha, it's good for us. It nourishes us. And we're going to eat lunch. We're going to learn and do and fulfill all those mitzvahs, whether we taste them or not. But isn't it more delicious when you have a delicious tasting lunch, when at least the hummus that you're having has a little bit of something in it, so it doesn't taste like sandpaper mixed with olive oil? It's much more enjoyable. So the Sefer HaChinuch says, look, we're going to do all the mitzvahs, but isn't it more meaningful if you could drill down and get to the shorish of where you find the connection to that mitzvah? And even though the Gemara says we have a rule, lo darshinan taima dekra, we paskin against Rabbi Shimon, we do not doresh, literally doresh means to learn up, in Yiddish you would say, to learn up the reason for a mitzvah, the tam also means a reason, lo darshinan taima dekra. What that means is the following. Rav Shechtel explained this to us many times. The pasuk says, in a particular context, do A, B, and C, and because of D, E, and F, it gives you the reason. So it's very evident what the reason for that mitzvah is. But if the Torah just says A, B, and C, You can't come up with your own suggestion and say, well, I think the reason is D, E, and F, and that's going to regulate the mitzvah. So let me give you an example. There is a din called Lo Sachbol Beged Almana, that you are not allowed to take the clothing of a widow as collateral. So it doesn't tell you why in that pasuk. It does not say why. However, Rabbi Shimon says, I'll give you a very good suggestion why. Because in antiquity, if a woman was living alone, very often that was a very difficult, financial, precarious position. In antiquity, it was very difficult to be a widow, and that's why the Torah always reminds us to make sure the ger, the yosam, and the almana are taken care of. It doesn't say the alman, it says the almana. So what does the Torah worry about? Reb Shimon says the following. He says, what happens? And in antiquity, this happened in the times of the Gemara. It happens, the Gemara describes how sometimes a couple would share one garment. They were so poor. It looked like, I guess, a poncho. And so they would share one garment. We can't even be masig. What kind of poverty that is, lo aleinu. The Gemara says, I'm worried about the following case. Let's say, God forbid, you have an almana who is absolutely, totally impoverished. So she only has one dress and one pair of pajamas. And she needs a loan. So she's going to give collateral, but she has nothing in her house. What's she going to give for collateral? So she says, no problem. She says to the banker, she says, well, during the day, I don't need my pajamas. And at night, I don't need my dress. So we'll swap every time. So Reb Shimon says, what's going to happen? The banker is going to say, great, I'm going to take your collateral and I'll lend you the money. And every day the banker should come at 8 o'clock at night and stand outside the door and hand her a pair of pajamas. And Reb Shimon says, that's terrible. How humiliating is that? How undignified is that? That's awful. So Reb Shimon says, well, what if this almana, this widow, her last name is Bloomingdale. She has a million dresses and a million pairs of pajamas. So she never has to worry that it's going to be a disrespect to her dignity. She has tons of dresses. She's going to tell the banker, go to the warehouse, you'll take tons of dresses. So Reb Shimon says, in that instance, the banker is allowed to take a collateral from the widow. Because there's no concern of disrespect, of taking away from her privacy. It's not a worry. But the Rabbanan Paskin, no. They say, you came up with the Tam HaMitzvah. What you think is the rationale for this mitzvah? It's very good. But you can't use that to now regulate the observance of the mitzvah. The Pasuk says you're not allowed to take collateral from a widow. You have to give her a loan without collateral. You can't take collateral even if their name is Bloomingdale's or Zales or Macy's, whatever it is. Does not matter. So we Paskin that even if we think we know what the reason for the mitzvah is, we follow the mitzvah irrespective of that. But, says the Sefer HaChinuch, it doesn't mean we shouldn't look for the meaning for ourselves. It doesn't mean that we can't think about what is a suggestion as to how we can relate to it. So even though we won't take collateral from an almana, even if that almana, Baruch Hashem, has a lot of means, but what is the Torah helping us understand? What it means to think about a situation that somebody else might be in that we can't identify with. So what do we need to do? We need to try to put ourselves in that person's shoes. We should never get to that place, God forbid. And if we are, we should be sensitive to them. It teaches us about sensitivity. That's what the tam, you could say, of that mitzvah is. So even though lo darshina tamah dekra, it doesn't mean we don't learn and seek out. So one of the very revolutionary aspects of the Sefer HaChinuch is that he says, you know what we're going to do? We're going to look for the tam hamitzvah. What's going to be a takeaway from us? You know, what does it mean to us in the year 2018 that the Torah says you shouldn't break bones of the Korban Pesach? We don't have a Korban Pesach. Unfortunately, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. So we don't have bones to break. There's nothing to talk about. But yet, says the Sefer HaChinuch, when we learn the mitzvah of not breaking bones of the Korban Pesach, we learn something about our life, our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, our Yiddishkeit. There's a takeaway for us. There's a message. So this is a big aspect. This is a huge aspect of learning the Sefer HaChinuch. So now that we understand all of this and the significance of this Sefer, it was published many times, who wrote it? So that is the unsolved mystery. Because nowhere in this sefer does it identify who the author is. It just says, in the end of the introduction, which we'll get to in a little bit, that it was an ish, somebody from Beis Levi mi Barcelona. So who is that? He obviously was an extremely accomplished Talmud Chacham, but who was he? Who was his Rebbe? What was his tradition? It's a mystery. And this mystery has occupied the focus of scholars for two centuries. Already in the 19th century, Rabbanim and scholars, there are works about who is the mysterious author of this work.
So it all appeared, all volumes, at once.
Yes. So now, there is a whole set, I was going to get to this in a second, there is a whole bunch of Kisvei Yad, of handwritten manuscripts, several handwritten manuscripts dating back to the beginning of the 14th century. So we know it's somebody who's living in Barcelona. We know it's somebody who's a Levi. We know that it's before the 1320s. But who is it?
And it wasn't passed down to students.
So there is it. Now, you know that in the beginning of the 16th century is something called the incunabular period. That's the beginning of the printing press. So there is one edition, the earliest printed edition from the incunabular period, that has a title page. And the title page says it's authored by Reb Aaron Halevi. Rabbi Aaron Halevi of Barcelona. And we say, we know who that is. We call him in the world of the yeshiva, we call him the Ra'ah, Reish Aleph Hey, Reb Aaron Halevi. Oh, we know who that is. A student of the Ramban, Nachmanides. The Ramban dies in 1274, give or take a little bit. So that's when it's going to be, Rabbi Aaron Halevi. And this was accepted for many years. But that was only in the printed edition from the 16th century. In the 19th century, some rabbis and scholars said, wait a minute. We're going to, and this is a tremendous scholarly work, which of course is a lifetime of achievement, but for some people apparently it's not. It's just no big deal. We're going to go through the entire Sefer HaChinuch, and we're going to compare what it says in the Sefer HaChinuch to everything that we know, all the writings that we have extant from the Ra'ah, Rabbi Aaron Halevi, and we're going to see, does that really match up? And the Ra'ah was a Talmud. His primary Rebbe was the Ramban, and Nachmanides, again, for next week. When he refers to the Ramban multiple times in here, does he say, my Rebbe, the esteemed, the outstanding, my beloved teacher? No. And there are a lot of other questions. The quote from the Chida, Reb Chaim Yosef David Azulai, saying, already in the 19th century, I'm not so sure about that. And then everybody's in a tizzy. Who is it? Even till this day. If you look in the introduction, there are two great editions of the Sefer HaChinuch, if you want to study this further. The first was published, I think, in the 50s by a Rabbi Charles B. Chevel, or Rav Chaim Chevel. So Rabbi Chevel, Dr. Chevel, in his edition, he has I printed out the whole, you can get it on Hebrew books, don't worry. He has a whole lengthy introduction where he quotes the many scholars before him and trying to figure out who it is. He has his own summary of all of the different proofs and the texts and everything. But I guess the closest, at least according to some, the closest suggestion is the following. At the end of the introduction, which we'll get to in a little bit, the Sefer HaChinuch writes why he called it the Sefer HaChinuch, the book of Chinuch. What is Chinuch? Education. So if it's called a book of education, who would it be written for? What's that? Yes, a student. So that's a hint. So he says, I wrote this, as we will see, I wrote this for my son to have something to do on Shabbos afternoon instead of just being outside basketball with the kids. So every week they have something to learn. It should be interesting for them. Apparently, says Professor Toshma, who was one of the most outstanding scholars of Hebrew. Before that, he was in Bar Ilan. He died in 2004. Yisrael Moshe Toshma. He was from the famous Israeli academic elite of Talmud study. He grew up in in Tel Aviv. He studied in Chevron Yeshiva, and then he went off to the world of academia. Very interesting, fascinating man who has extensive, over 150 articles. He says, I'll tell you who it is. And he proves it in his article. He says, you know it is. The Ra'ah had a brother. Ta-da! His name was Reb Pinchas. And this brother of the Ra'ah was an older brother who, of course, Tashma knew everything that the Ra'ah had ever written and everything that his brother had ever written. These outstanding academics, literally, I had one of them as a professor. His name is Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik. When he said, this is the only time the Ritva says A, that's the only time he ever said it. So Tashma says it was actually, and he's not the first one to observe this, and he proves it, he says it's the brother of the Ra'ah, Reb Pinchas. Because the Ra'ah in one place talks about my brother, my nephew, Reb Yehoshua. Because the Ra'ah's brother, Reb Aaron's brother, Pinchas, was older than him. He was his teacher. And he says, Professor Tashma, if you take the teachings of Reb Pinchas, the brother of the Ra'ah, and you match them up with the few writings, the scant writings that we have elsewhere, they match up perfectly. He was a contemporary of the Ramban, not a student of the Ramban. So it would make sense that a lot of places he'll mention the Ramban, but he won't refer to him with this kind of honorific because he wasn't a student of the Ramban. And then, he says, fascinating in this article, he says, I published this, and then a bunch of scholars wrote to me, and then he just wipes the floor with their questions. And he says, it's perfect because this young man, Yehoshua, who was the nephew of Rabbi Aaron HaLevi, is referenced once in the Ra'ah's writings. He says, oh, I have this nephew, and Tashma connects all the dots. He says, that's the boy who was 11 years old, whose father wrote him the Sefer Achim. Which means that it was probably written, it was written after the death of the Ramban, because he refers to the Ramban as the deceased, the late Ramban. That means that it was written probably somewhere around the year 1300. Give or take a couple of years. So I can't say for sure that's the solved mystery. It's still unsolved because there's some people who don't like Tashma's suggestion. But that's the background. So you're talking about it being written in Spain after several centuries already, it's an extended period, you could say, of Christian difficulty. And they're living in Barcelona, and that's not going to last for a long time, right? That's going to be in the beginning of the end of the period of Spanish Jews. Ad Khan for the significance and the background and the discussion about the Sefer. So you have in front of you, in your packet, the entirety of the Hakdama, the introduction of the Sefer Achinuch.
Just out of curiosity, does the Minchas Chinuch talk about this question at all in the Sefer?
So the Minchas Chinuch, so Jeff is alluding to the fact that on the side of this comment, of this book, is a very important commentary, especially anybody here from Galicia. Those of us who are Galicianers, we're very proud of the Minchas Chinuch. I had a great uncle, Zichrono Livracha, who was my grandfather, my paternal grandfather's brother. They were like two peas in a pod. My grandfather was very social. My great uncle, to rest in peace, was very antisocial. They worked together. They were two peas in a pod. So they were in the war together, so my grandfather made all the Shabbos arrangements, and then you know, my uncle would come along. So my uncle was a very gruff guy. He had gigantic eyebrows, enormous, huge eyebrows. And he was a tremendous Talmud Chacham. He went through all of Minchas Chinuch three times. He went through Shas like six or seven times, but he went through all of Minchas Chinuch six or seven times. And I wondered, I never asked him, I was probably too scared, but I wondered if part of the reason that he loved the Minchas Chinuch was because our family is from Galicia, and he's one of the most influential great Galicianish Rabbanim. So on the side of the Sefer Achinuch is an amplification, a commentary called Minchas Chinuch, which is a play on a rabbinic term from a karban. But his Hakdama, it's very brief. He just has like five lines. That's it. Five, six lines. He assumes, he says, that it's miyuchas l'ra'ah. It is attributed to the ra'ah. But he doesn't take a stand. He doesn't really care that much. He says it's miyuchas to the ra'ah. Why does he say it's attributed to the ra'ah? Because apparently it's not 100% clear. Any other questions, comments, or observations thus far? So the question that we need to think about is, how in the next 30 minutes are we going to learn this entire Hakdama?
It's not
from beginning to end. It's pretty awesome. So what I did was the following, and we'll find out if this is a good idea or a bad idea. I took the Hakdama, the way that it's broken down here in the Machon Yerushalayim edition. I went to Sepharia, and online, I formatted the text that you have in front of you. It's also, I think it's available in English in Sepharia, but I didn't bother with the English. I have an English edition at home, but I felt like it was a little chaval on the trees, because we're not going to go through the whole thing inside. And I broke it down into 15, or at the end, 16 pieces, according to the way that the paragraphs are broken down in the Machon Yerushalayim edition. And the way that we can approach it, perhaps, is in the following way. Because what the Sefer HaChinuch does in his introduction is really astonishing. Because he wants to lay out for us the entirety of the Jewish religion as it relates to our observance of mitzvahs. So what he does is he asks some big questions. Each of these questions on their own is worthy of many hours of study and many different opinions and all kinds of depth and research. So what I did was, some of you who are about to be called on by name, so if you're sleeping, get ready. I broke it up by paragraph and by question. So for example, Nathan Block happens to have a very important question right in front of him, which we're going to ask him to read out loud with so much enthusiasm, and that will help kick off the discussion. And we're going to follow each question one at a time. The questions are broken down by the paragraphs. Again, those paragraphs are coming from the breakdown of the Machon Yerushalayim edition. They're not authoritative. They're not the original. I don't know if Reb Pinchas, the brother of the Ra'ah, if he was here, if he would like this or not, but we're going to try to make this as meaningful to us as possible, because otherwise it would take us, I don't know, years to go through this, and we don't have that kind of time. All right, so Nathan, if you were to open up with a very important question about Judaism, thinking about, I'm going to write a book of mitzvahs for my kid who has, you know, doesn't necessarily have a whole world of knowledge. He has questions. Well, where would you start with your questions?
How do we know the Torah is true?
Good question, right?
Throw me out, right?
Great question. Isn't that a good place to start if you're going to write an introduction of all the mitzvahs? So he says, well, let's start with the following. In section Aleph, he says, you know, the fact is that to establish truth requires acceptance, people to be on the same page, agreement. And everybody agrees that the more witnesses you have about a particular episode, a particular event, the greater level of belief and trust and veracity you can lend to that. So, for example, to use an analogy from the Kusari, maybe Paul can answer this question from a personal experience, but how do we know that India exists? It's a British, it used to be a British territory, but not anymore. How do we know that India exists? Oh, okay. For the rest of us, I've never been to India. So if the only person who came to tell me about India was Mrs. Geller, I would say, I trust Mrs. Geller, very wonderful lady. She's been at the Shir for a long time. I know her. I know her family. There's no reason that she would lie to me that there is a place called India, right? We've seen postcards from India. She has selfies in front of the Taj Mahal. But the truth is, it's only one person. But when hundreds and hundreds of people come and tell us, and there are pictures, and there's documents and supporting evidence that there is a place called India, we can all agree in this room that there is a place called India. So says the Sefer HaChinuch, the more people who come to tell you about something, the greater you believe it. If everybody here had gone on a trip to India and come to somebody and said, you know, there's a place called India, that person would say, oh, everybody said it. So he says, the origin of Judaism, of our religion, of our tradition, is an experience at Sinai of 600,000 people. That's just the men. And then you add the women and the children. The concept of mass revelation, which is then passed down from generation to generation, it relies on this notion that we trust people to relay various events. But what's unique here, says the Sefer HaChinuch, is the large number of people. It's not that somebody was in upstate New York and says, you know, last night I found something in my basement. Or I had a vision, a solitary vision. One person had a solitary vision. Maybe he had one too many drinks. I don't know. You know, how can I know solitary vision? So that's the first part, says the Sefer HaChinuch. The second part of that experience, if you go down, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I don't know, 7, 8 lines down, the first word on the line is b'mehem, hamaisa, it happened, that act, that action, that activity, that event happened in their days, v'ro'osu be'einayim, and they saw it with their eyes, rabim, lots of people, yischazik hadavar b'lev habanim, that will be strengthened, strong in the hearts of their children, hashomim, who hear that. Therefore, next line, Alkein kesheratzel Elokim lasis his Torah la'amo, God wanted to give Torah to his people. What did he do? He gave it in public. And not only that, there is an additional component, and that is, go down to the word u'binvuascha, that what? Shekol nevuascha emes v'lulei shezachu l'nevua. Next line, b'chol ha'osa she'osa moshe l'eini par l'einem ha'yachol baldin lachlok. Says the Sefer HaChinuch, the second thing is that the people had an experience of prophecy. Because if they didn't achieve the level of prophecy, somebody could say, oh, that was just some kind of magical show. That was a Penn and Teller shtick. You know, you pulled out the lightning and everybody was moved. But how do you know that's an authentic experience? So says the Sefer HaChinuch in answer to the first question, which was, how do we know that the Torah is true? Well, first of all, it was a mass revelation. And second of all, he says, and we included the experience of prophecy for all the people, not just one person. And that is what is being transmitted. And now, parenthetically, by the way, that's why the whole experience of Pesach is so important. Because if we don't talk to our children and talk to our parents and pass along that tradition, so then the whole Jewish religion falls apart. So that is the first step that he wants to take. You can't go without that. We got the Torah at Sinai. Everybody saw it. Everybody experienced prophecy. So now what happens, Brad? What else would you ask if there was a burning question? This is your chance.
I'm glad I made it back into this.
Thank you.
Should I re-examine the truth for myself or trust my parents/teachers?
Okay. So we have this tradition. Why don't we say, you know what, forget what everybody told me until now. I'm going to examine it for myself. So says the Sefer HaChinuch in section B's. He says, on the top line, somebody might say to you halfway down the line, Malacha ha'ishu diva kabalascha. Malacha l'shol avicha u'zakeinacha. Why do you ask your parents? Why do you ask your elders? Don't ask them. Figure it out yourself. Why listen to other people? Fourth line down, halfway down the line. Nashive love, we'll tell him. Ki mitzad chakirosenu lo nuchal lahasig la'olam bedvar ha'elokim klum.
Is it possible, he says, for one person to get all the answers to anything in life?
He says, take a scientist. Can a solitary scientist doing their own research in their own lab, ignoring everything else that's going around in the world, ignoring all the other knowledge and information that has been gleaned until now, can somebody say, you know, I'm going to train this scientist to exist without knowing about Pasteur, without knowing about Newton, without knowing about Einstein? How much can that person really know with their own self-exploration starting from ground zero? It's impossible. It's so limited. And he says, Chalila, three lines later, Chalila lanu chalila lavo acharei ha-melech begavheinu laharim yad v'lachsho machshava. Somebody should come along with such arrogance to deny and ignore the testimony of all those who came before us and just say, oh, I'm going to figure it out on my own. It's totally foolish. It's ridiculous. Now, he's not saying that a person shouldn't strive on their own to understand and to appreciate. Vaharaya, remember, he's the one who is innovating the idea of searching for the meaning. But that doesn't exclude, it doesn't preclude the idea that the basis of it is foundationally a tradition, which is part of the reason for those who joined us last year, why we spent a whole year talking about Masorah. Because even though you can go to a seminar where somebody will show you a quote-unquote proof of God from this and a proof of God from that, which works for a lot of people, but at the end of the day, emunah doesn't work based on proofs of God. It's nearly impossible to prove God. It comes back to the tradition that we have. And if we don't strengthen that tradition, so then it's going to erode our experience of Yahdus. So we need to reinforce that tradition. So I guess then, Mrs. Gershman, what would be the next question that we need to ask ourselves?
Why did God give the Torah to mankind?
In the first place, right? It's all good that we understand where it comes from, so the question is why? That's a great question. So go to section Gimel. Im Yishal HaShoel. If somebody would ask, Ma'in Yin Shenasin Hashem Torah Yikara Kazul Bnei Adam, why would Torah be given to us in the first place? Third line. Shuvaso shol zepshuta she'ein das bnei adam masig bedarke yotzro ladas tamasa of lama kigav udracha midarcheim. If we want to build a meaningful world in this existence, we can't on our own, being physical human beings, grasp what is the divine wisdom that guides this world. So God did us a favor. He gave us an insight, a manual, how to understand the spiritual underpinnings of this life. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world and did us a favor by giving us hadracha. The Torah is, like in Hebrew, you would say, you want somebody to be a tour guide, you would say you want a moreh derech, a guidebook. So the Torah is a moreh derech. That's why he gave it to us. Because to create a world without giving us a shot to bring godliness into it, we can't figure it out on our own. We need some kind of direction. Ah, so if that's the case, so then, I can't read my own handwriting here. I think it starts with a G. George. Right. George, what would be your question now? Thanks, George.
The Torah is real. I believe it should be given to mankind. I believe my parents. So why? What's so special about the Jews?
Right. Why did he give it to the Jews? What a great question. Section Dalid. V'im Yishalod. If this is the point of the creation, why did God only give it to the Jews? Lomanit nala'am echad. So he has a suggestion, interestingly. He says, look, the fact is, if you look around in life, let's say if you look at water, how much of the Earth's water is potable, is drinking water? What's that? Small, small amount. How much of the land is fertile and good for growing things? Right? A large percentage?
No.
Not. So he has an interesting ha'ara. He says, first of all, from a physical standpoint, generally speaking, the successful projects in the physical world exist in a small scale. What he calls psolus meruba al ha'ochel. You derive a successful nugget from a huge pursuit of sifting through the dirt in the gold rush. So he says it's also true spiritually, that there is a whole mass of different nations and different people, but it's only going to be successful in one small group. Now, that doesn't mean, and we'll talk about this in a later Hakdama later in the year, that doesn't mean that non-Jews have no role, right? Where's Mark?
Mira.
I'm sorry, Mara, yes, says Mark. Mara. Yeah, so Mara, so then the question will be.
So in that case, what is the role of the Nazis?
Oh, it's amazing you asked. So that's why in number hey, he says, Ulam gam l'kol shar min ha'adam nosan derech lahav dilam min ha'behemos v'hem zayin mitzvah shenitztabu v'hem. That's why non-Jews were given the 7 Noahide laws, to give them the spiritual guidance and elevation. So if that's good, so where's Barry? Oh, so now what happens, Barry? If we discuss the distinctness of the Jewish people vis-a-vis other nations.
Why do Jews suffer?
So why do the Jews have to suffer so much? Eich hadavar in Vav. Eich hadavar shem sov le hagolos vatsaros. Why do we have to suffer so much with so many exiles? Top of the next column. He says, you know why? Because the truth is, there are two realms. There is the spiritual realm and the physical realm. And va'olam ha'gufos ke'efes v'so nechshav. It looks like, if you compare the physical realm and the spiritual realm is literally nothing. The spiritual realm is left for eternity. That's what really exists. That's true reality. The neshamas are what are real, and the guf is nothing. And therefore, the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us the spiritual endowment, and the physical endowment he left us to suffering over the generations. Ooh.
That's counterintuitive.
Steve.
So why did God have to choose to give Jews a spiritual portion and not a physical?
Why couldn't he just give us both? You notice, by the way, that when Yitzchak Avinu went to bless his sons, he split the blessing and he gave one to the man he thought was Esav and the one he thought was Yaakov. Yitzchak was not confused. He knew that there are two blessings, there are two realms. He was going to give one to Esav and one to Yaakov. So when Esav comes crying to him and says, you know, Habaracha Achas, is that what it says? You have one more, and what does he say? He says, oh, I'm so sorry. When did he give it? But it's not true. He says, I have no more for you. Because in his pocket, he had another bracha. At the end of the parsha, it says, V'yitin lecha es birkas Avraham. There was one more blessing. But that he had in his pocket. He wasn't giving to Esav. That was only for Yaakov. And obviously, Rivka had a different perspective, and there's a lot to discuss. But the idea that there are two realms. So the question is, why does Hashem primarily according? Now, each, just a reminder, each of these can be debated. There are other answers to these questions, but this is his systematic approach.
There is one. There is one little gap. Yes. One little piece that he misses. It goes from why do we suffer? Because there's the other world. Okay. But somebody could say, how do you know there's another world? It's not, you don't see it in...
Oh, so he's going to get to that in a second. So he's going to get to that in the next point in Ches. We'll get to that in a second. So this, let's start with Steve's in Zion. Lama lo nasan hakel la'amo shnei manos. Why didn't he give us both? So his answer, essentially, is that yes, in Yemos HaMashiach, we'll get both. But it is, how can we expect that we're going to be able to handle both? Yadua lakol bal sechel she'ef shel bal chomer ba'olam mibli she'yechta umimidos hakel baruchu hakavus adead himidas hadin. He says if we're too involved in the physical realm, we're going to run into a lot of problems. We're going to run into a lot of pitfalls. And therefore, we're going to have to suffer the consequences of those mistakes. So God did us a favor by saying, don't be involved so much in the physical, spend more time on the spiritual. This way we avoid these potential pitfalls, and that's why the Gemara says in Yemos HaMashiach, the pitfalls, the physical barriers will be removed, and we'll be able to succeed in both realms. That's his suggestion. So now, I would have given you this, but we gave it to Cheryl. Who has
why
that?
Why doesn't the Torah mention spiritual
reward? Right? He covers all the bases, right?
Yeah. I'm surprised he put it over here as opposed to before, but that's
at least that one I could read on my paper.
No, that's awesome. Yeah.
So he says, I don't understand it, Ches. If that's the main thing, the main thing is Olam HaNeshamos, so then, Lama Lo Yaski Reno BaTorah. Why doesn't the Torah mention it? If the main thing is the spiritual world, why can you read the whole Chumash and not talk about it? He says, tshuva, he says, that it is so obvious, it did not need to be mentioned. He said, this interesting suggestion.
I've heard you're an idiot.
He says, yodua v'nigla l'kol bal seichel, all nations, everybody knows, ki mach tzev ha-nefesh ha-sichlis mimotze ha-seichel. He says, everybody knows there is a spiritual dimension of people. Rabbi Sachs, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs has a great way of framing this. I don't know anybody who denies the notion of love. Well, love is obviously a spiritual experience. It's not physical. Friendship, closeness, feelings, those are all ruchni. Those are all spiritual. And so, says the Sefer HaChinuch, this is his opinion, you don't have to agree. He says, it is obvious to all human beings, if you are thinking, that there is a dimension of us which is not just organic, it's not just physical. And that's why he notes that in his experience, in all cultures, and now we know this, I can't speak for every culture, but we know that there are so many rituals, we know this across the board. I've heard recently about a particular Chinese ritual that when a person passes away, they perform this ritual because it relates to the neshama of that person. So obviously, these rituals take a lot different form than the way that we acknowledge the passing of the neshama from this world to the other world. But b'ikaron, that Chinese ritual, and by the way, the Gemara used to talk, the Tamar talks, they used to have sapdanim, professional eulogizers. In China, they have professional weepers. They have women who are outstanding weepers, and if you can afford it...
The Gemara talks about yeah, that. We had it too. Yeah.
That's, I just said, that's exactly it. Sapdanim.
Yeah.
So if you can, if you're in China, you can hire a professional weeper for your levaya, which is good.
Do you have a phone number? I think I might need it.
You have to Google it. You have to Google it. But the point is, according to Sefer HaChinuch, you know why, in answer to Cheryl's question, you know why the Torah doesn't mention spiritual work? Because everybody knows that's what it's all about. So that's very interesting. So, Francie, what happens now?
That's the question. What's the point of the Torah?
Got it. So now we got the Torah. We understand why it's Dafka, the Jewish people. It's our spiritual focus. So now, in section Tes, HaTorah HaZos Shamarnu Shenasan Hashem La'amo Al Yidei Moshe Nevi'o, that the Torah which was given to us by Moshe, his prophet, what's the main purpose of it? Me'ikarel Ladas Ki Hashem Ho'elokim. The main thing is that to know that there is a God. Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Bardichev once called an assembly on a Tuesday afternoon. He told everybody in the village, come to the shul, there's something urgent, we need to make an announcement. So the villagers were all petrified. What could be on a Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock that the Rebbe has an emergency? Maybe, God forbid, there's a pogrom. Maybe there's some kind of crisis. They all get in the shul, you can imagine, little Yidlach hanging from the rafters. The chassidim are packed in like this. You have the skinny chevra, and then you have the not-so-skinny. Everybody's packed in, and they're hanging from the chandeliers and everything. And Rabbi Levi Yitzchak gets up to the duch, and he says, chevra, I have to tell you, there is a God. I hope you have a great day. And that was it. Sometimes we forget, in everything that's going on, with all the everything, the main thing is to remember there is a God. As the Rav said, Rav Soloveitchik, he learned from his mother, what's the most important thing in life? To feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of his hands resting upon my frail shoulders. That's the main thing. And to do that, we have a Torah. And that Torah is given to us in a written form, and then, turn the page, at the end of the test, it's explicated in an oral tradition. So now, Ari...
Why is the oral tradition essential to Judaism?
Ah, so why do you need the oral tradition? Why is that crucial? So he says, V'chol mishal libo nokfo. Of course, this is crucial because, take a look, let's go down to section Yud. From the simple reading of the Torah text, Bilti pirushim v'kabbalasim, without their explanations and their traditions, amitis lo naskim el ha'emes la'olam. A person who only opens up the Old Testament and reads it straight will never understand the truth of it. There are so many gaps. There are so many inconsistencies at first glance. You can go to the library and get this book, which I got because it was hilarious, called The Year of Living Biblically. We mentioned it once before. Hilarious book. A guy who tries to live according to the Chumash in Manhattan. It's already... It's impossible. We all know that it is essential to have a tradition to understand when it says ayin tachas ayin, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from us. And when it says that a person needs to immerse in a mikvah, well, how big? How tall? How long? What does it mean to eat matzah? What does it mean to... All these things, it's impossible from that one small divine document. So he says, without that, you couldn't really understand what it means at all. So now, Paul, any questions?
How many mitzvot?
Ah, so now that we've gotten why there's a Torah and how we're going to develop, so we now go to Yud Aleph. Now we have a Kabbalah that the cheshbon of the mitzvos is second line in Yud Aleph. Ola Taryag Mitzvos. Comes up to 613 mitzvos. So now, if you had to emphasize what is the most central pursuit of all those mitzvos, Glenn, what would you say? Ready?
What is the most fundamental mitzvah?
Ah, so he says, the yisod of everything in Yud Beis, shekulon nishanos elof hi mitzvos limud ha-Torah. It's the learning of the Torah. If you don't learn it, you won't know everything. So the primary objective we're going to have is to learn all of Torah. We're going to learn all these mitzvahs. How can you observe sukkahs if you don't learn how to make a sukkah? How can you learn about developing a connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu if you don't know anything about God? So now, we understand why we're going to need to learn it. So once we're going to learn it...
Why write a Sefer HaChinuch?
Why write a Sefer HaChinuch? To address exactly this question, right? Because now, we understand why you're going to write a Sefer HaChinuch. Because... Yud Dalet. I'm going to write on each one. I'm sorry. Yud Gimel. I'm going to write down this mitzvah. Third line. Go to your third line. I'm sorry. Torah was Yud Beis. Yud Gimel, go to the third line in the white section. Al Kain Ra'isi Tov Ani Hadal Ba'alfei Talmid HaTalmidim. Me, the pauper of students. Shebizmani Ish Yehudi. Key line here. Me Beis Levi Barceloni. I, the man from the house of Levi from Barcelona, lichtov amitzvos al derech hasdarim, to write it according to the parshas haShavua, uchseda shenichtovu betorah zu achar zu leorer lev hanar, to inspire my child, bini, my kid, vahayeladim chaverav, and the other kids in the neighborhood, bekol shavua v'shavua, every Shabbos afternoon they should have something to do. Sheyilmedu oso haseder b'cheshbon ha-mitzvos, ulahargil osam b'hem, ulahatvis machshavosam, to grab their attention, to make it interesting for them, to make it exciting. My wife told me that when she was growing up, one of the things they used to do at the Shabbos table every week was to learn a mitzvah from the Sefer HaChinuch. So I don't know, not all the mitzvahs are super exciting, let's be honest. Pidyon Petra Chamor for some people is very exciting, for some, not as much. But he says, the job of this was to take this whole Masorah, all of the mitzvahs and everything, and give it to the kids that it should be interesting for them to learn on Shabbos. Now go to Yud Dalet. Mrs. Poland, what do we have left?
Should we aspire to find meaning behind the mitzvah?
Exactly. So now you're going to make it interesting for people. You want to make it inspiring. So we're going to go back to what is one of his unique contributions, which was the Tameh HaMitzvos. Vadaiti lichsov al kol achas remez. I'm going to try to write about each one. A little hint. Mishar she HaMitzvah HaNigla. And he says, I don't think, second line here in Yud Dalet, Eini choshev v'gozer lahagia la'emes. I'm not so arrogant to think, oh, I'm going to get to the divine truth. I'm going to know what God had in mind. No, chas v'shalom, third line. Mi komoni talas v'lo ish. Who is like me? I'm like a worm. I'm a nothing. Shalorom oros chachba kol hayomim. I don't know anything. I know a little bit. But nonetheless, omnam lo chasarti das. Nonetheless, I'm still going to try to understand on my level, each one of us. We have to try on our level to understand how the Torah HaKadosh is speaking to us. Not to be presumptuous to think, I'm going to tell you exactly what God's reason is. But to say, well, I'm living in a certain time and the Torah is infinite and it's forever. So how do I connect to it in my lifetime, in my experience? So even though, third line from the end of this section, in Yud Dalet, Ani amarti, ach amarti, mi yitein v'tiyem achshavasi nitredes b'zeh kol hayomim. It's a good thing to think about. V'lo tipasa v'lo tipogim v'mizmos amal v'oven k'mo risham ha-shem v'kochosam. It says, at least I should try, let me do the best that I can, and understand it. And therefore, he concludes, and with this we're going to finish up. Mrs. Taxer, I think you're next online. What do we have here?
Is this work holy and meaningful?
So now that we understand, this is my best shot, says the author of the Sefer HaChinuch. Is everything in here correct? Is everything in here true? Maybe not. Maybe not. I'm not so arrogant to tell you that everything you're going to find in this book is absolutely 100% foolproof. It says, maybe not. Halo kulon tsrufos utahoros kol evin yakar mishukhasan im bameshi yechto bepirusham psoles, if you will find psoles, something that you don't like, nim saleitim yizbarecha ochel mitocho. Sometimes you'll find something that's delicious. You go in the fruit bin, sometimes you find fruit that's been there for too long. Doesn't mean you throw out the whole fruit bin. It means you find a peach that's still good. Says the author of the Sefer HaChinuch, I'm going to make a suggestion. I'm not guaranteeing you that every inyan here is 100% al derech ha'emes. Maybe you will like it, maybe you won't like it. But my hope is that you'll find something meaningful. And he concludes, V'rosh and Tezayin, V'diglo alai ava, L'glugo alai ava. Sometimes even the mistakes, they're also loving, they're also cute. You know, we try our best. You ever watch a child who's 2 years old or a year and a half old, and they walk like this, they walk funny, we all laugh, it's very cute. It's endearing. Ah, they fell down, it was a little bit silly. He says that's also part of a relationship. So he says, I have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I'm going to walk along the path with the Ribbono Shel Olam, even though sometimes maybe one of my pshatim is not going to be good, it'll look a little bit silly, but that's okay, it's part of a relationship with love. And so we step back and we say, wow, this is an incredibly ambitious work from this Ishmi Beis Levi from Barcelona. Each one of these questions, and I thank all our volunteers, Biyodim or Belo Yodim, well, you knew you were getting it or not, or I wrote your name down wrong, but the idea of thinking about one man who's going to set out to write a sefer of all the mitzvahs for his kid to learn on a Shabbos with his friends, and to come up with a novel way of presenting it to them so that it'll be interesting, and that it will teach them how to connect to the whole Yiddishkeit and the totality of it, what an incredible idea. And the fact that this sefer, we have manuscripts, tons of manuscripts, and tons of svarim. You know what that means? What does it mean? That's right. Everyone throughout the generations, everybody loved it. Everybody connected to it. Otherwise, it would have been in the dustbin of history. The fact that Rabbi Shevel, in the introduction, he counts each. You can go to Oxford, you can go to Russia, you can go all these different places where they have manuscripts. Then they have published. Why? Because it's so precious. Jews want to connect. We want to find a way to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And one of the great gifts that we have to do that, to connect to Torah in a meaningful way, is this work, the Sefer HaChinuch. Have a terrific week. Shalom.